Now, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The families of two Trinidadian men killed by U.S. boat strike in the Caribbean are suing the Trump administration for wrongful death and extrajudicial killing. On October 14th, Chad Joseph, who was 26 years old, and Rishi Samaru, who was 41, were on a small vessel headed back to Trinidad from Venezuela when their boat was targeted, killing all six people on board. Soon after, President Trump released video of the strike on social media, referring to those killed as narco-terrorists. The families of Joseph and Samaru say both men had been away from home working on Venezuelan farms and fishing and were simply returning home. At least 125 people have been killed in the unprecedented bombing campaign on civilian boats in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific since September. This is Chad Joseph's uncle, Pop Salvary, speaking about President Trump.
He's supposed to face murder charges because it's a criminal offense. You cannot be bombing people's boats, you know, like that, you know. On saying international water and saying narco trafficking, and raise your proof, you know? Raise your proof.
Well, the families say neither man was involved in narco trafficking, and their attorneys have laid out arguments for why these strikes were illegal under all circumstances. For more, we're joined by Bahar Azmi, legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, attorney for the families. Welcome to Democracy Now! Lay out their case and who these two young men are.
Yeah, these are two Trinidadian citizens. They're sort of itinerant farmers and fishermen who had been long awaiting for a ride home from Venezuela, where they worked, and were assassinated on their boat along with four other people. And it's just sort of, I think, the latest example of the Trump administration's total mockery of, contempt for, the post-World War II human rights consensus, where nations are constrained by law and not mere might. And under that law, nation states can't just sort of willy-nilly declare war on some entity, like some unspecified drug cartel, and then use military force. The conditions for an armed conflict aren't there. And so, therefore, this is just an outright cold-blooded murder.
So let's talk about the laws. Yeah. Your suit was filed under two federal statutes, the Death on the High Seas Act, a law that allows family members to sue for wrongful deaths occurring on the high seas, and the Alien Tort Statute, which allows, well, tell us about foreign citizens to sue in U.S. federal courts for human rights violations. Explain both.
Yes. Yeah, so the Death on the High Seas Act is a species of U.S. admiralty law. It's a statute that authorizes individuals to sue the United States government for wrongful death, and wrongful death here is synonymous with illegality. And because there's no legal justification, there was no war, these were civilians, it's illegal under any peacetime or wartime paradigm, and then just constitutes simple murder. And then the Alien Tort Statute allows foreign nationals to sue for egregious human rights violations, which is an extrajudicial killing, an arbitrary deprivation of life. So we're pursuing these claims with our partners at the ACLU.
Earlier this week, Congress held the first public hearing to address U.S. involvement in Venezuela. This is 5 months after the unprecedented bombing campaign against alleged drug trafficking boats in the Caribbean began. This is Senator Tim Kaine.
I'd like to talk about the complete weakness of the legal rationale about the strikes on boats in international waters, but I can't because the administration has only shared it with members in a classified setting. I can't tell you why the domestic rationale is hollow and the international rationale is hollow. I can't tell you why the rationale for attacking Venezuela is hollow because, again, the rationale has been shared with us in a closed setting. I can't talk to you about the weakness of the targeting criteria being used to attack boats in the Caribbean and Pacific. I would encourage any colleague, if you have not, go to the classified setting and ask for a briefing on each strike and ask this question: what was the evidence that there were narcotics on that craft? You will be very surprised if you ask that question about every strike.
So if you can respond to what he's saying, and if you expect to learn new information and discovery in these suits, something that senators and everyone else have not been able to learn.
Yeah, I mean, he's right. The purported legal justification, the memo that somehow authorizes this, is being kept secret at the same time the administration sort of postures and boasts about the legality of this. And with the ACLU, we filed a separate FOIA lawsuit to try and get that memorandum. Under any legal theory, there's no way these killings are justified. In the end, they're like ultimately, I think, killings for sport and for spectacle. And no more can the U.S. military assassinate civilians on the high seas than paramilitary forces can shoot civilian protesters in the face or in the back. We're seeking accountability, justice for the victims, and a clear ruling that we cannot kill with impunity.
Barr, before you go, I want to ask you about what's happening in Minnesota. And you may not know this latest news. Just been reported that the former CNN anchor Don Lemon and independent journalist Georgia Fort have been arrested. Mm-hmm. Last week, they both reported on a peaceful protest at a St. Paul church where a top ICE official serves as pastor. Lemon's attorney, the famed free speech lawyer Abby Lowell, called his arrest a, quote, unprecedented attack on the First Amendment. Lowell went on to say, quote, instead of investigating the federal agents who killed two peaceful Minnesota protesters, the Trump Justice Department is devoting its time, attention, and resources to this arrest. And that is the real indictment of wrongdoing in this case, Abby Lowell said. Mm-hmm. Your final comment.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's happening in Minneapolis is this sort of terrifying deployment of Trump's brown shirts, you know, incentivized 50 grand vigilantes. And this, the punishment of journalists or perceived political opponents, and to connect it to your prior segment, I think a bit of a dry run, a rehearsal for deployment of troops during elections.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Bahar Azmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, attorney for the two families of two Trinidadian men killed off the coast of Venezuela in a U.S. boat strike on October 14th. The case is Burnley versus the United States. When we come back, hundreds of thousands of Haitians could lose their TPS status, their right to work in the United States legally. We're going to speak with a health professional from Haiti who lives in Florida about what this means. Stay with us.
When I came for the immigrants, I got in their face. When I came for the refugees, I got in their face. When they came for the five-year-olds, I got in their face. When they came to my neighborhood, I just got in their face. They used tear gas and pepper spray against our whistles and our phones. But in this city of heroes, we will protect our home. When they drag people from their cars, I got in their face. When they took families from their homes, I got in their face. When they murdered our sister, I got in their face. And when they murdered our brother, I still got in their face. In Dachau, Martin Niemöller suffered for his complicity. But in this city of heroes...
City of Heroes by Billy Bragg, about Minneapolis. To hear the first part, go to democracynow.org. This is democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Trump's deportation campaign. With temporary protected status, TPS, for immigrants from Haiti scheduled to end next week, February 3rd. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. is expected to rule any day on a request to pause the termination of TPS for Haitians. An estimated 350,000 Haitians with TPS protections could face deportation. About 150,000 others still have pending TPS applications. That's according to Haitian Bridge Alliance. As Haitian communities and supporters nationwide continue to fight, local officials in Springfield, Ohio, are bracing for a surge in ICE agents to the city if TPS relief for Haitians is not extended past the February 3rd deadline. The city was at the center of President Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance's racist smears against Haitians when they said they're eating cats and dogs. This comes as a federal appeals court has ruled that Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem illegally ended protections for immigrants from Venezuela and Haiti. It's yet to be determined how this will impact Haiti's TPS case. The Supreme Court last year allowed Noem's bid to end TPS for Venezuelans. For more, we are joined by two guests. Gerline Joseph is co-founder and executive director of Haitian Bridge Alliance, and Maurice Baltazar is a former journalist and certified nursing assistant from Haiti who currently has temporary protected status. She was once president of the Haitian Women's Journalism Association. She fled Haiti after the devastating earthquake in 2010. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Gerline, let's begin with you. Explain what's at stake.
Good morning, Amy. What is at stake is that we have over almost half a million Haitians living in the United States at risk of losing everything. That includes family separation due to deportation, where we have children, U.S.-born children, at risk of losing their parents if TPS is not redesignated and extended for Haiti. As you mentioned, we are currently in the court fighting for the lives of over 350,000 Haitians, and we are hoping to get a favorable ruling from the judge in Washington, D.C. However, in order to cover half a million people, we need a redesignation and extension of TPS for Haiti.
So you came into our studio, we spoke, and then you headed off to Springfield. That was a while ago last year. Again, for people to understand, I remember watching the Republican governor of Ohio talk about going to Haiti a number of times. They were really recruiting Haitians to Springfield to enliven, to resuscitate Springfield, Ohio. And instead, you had the Republican vice president, J.D. Vance, going after Haitians there, tens of thousands of people, as he talked about the Haitians in Springfield, Ohio, eating cats and dogs. Talk about what's happened since.
We are back at it again, Amy. As I'm speaking to you, we have been coordinating to respond to what we are hearing will be a major ICE raid in cities like Springfield, Ohio, San Diego, and others. We are heading to Springfield to make sure we are observing what's happening within the community and also supporting our clients and our community members on the ground. So we are hearing those things, and the community is traumatized. We are living under a cloud of terror where we do not know what will happen, because from what we are hearing, there is a 30-day ICE raid that is being planned for major cities where Haitian Americans are, specifically targeting Springfield, Ohio, Charleroi, Pennsylvania, and others. So we are bracing ourselves. Not only are we fighting in the front line to make sure that we secure safety for the people through the lawsuits, sending a letter to President Trump to ask him to reconsider and extend and redesignate TPS for Haiti, but also bracing ourselves for what can be catastrophic within the community if indeed ICE descends on Springfield, Ohio, in New York City and other places that we are hearing right now.
I mean, it's amazing that you have the governor of Ohio, Mike DeWine, talking about recruiting Haitians, the Haitian community, to come to Springfield to revitalize it. And at the same time, in Lewiston, Maine, you have the mayor having talked about recruiting Somalis, the Somali community, come and revitalize downtown Lewiston. And yet now the pressure on these communities. I wanted to bring in Maurice Baltazar, certified nurse from Haiti, living in the U.S. living in Florida. She was the former president of the Haitian Women's Journalists Association. She's a certified nursing assistant. Maurice, can you talk about what this means?
Good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me. What this means to me, the end of TPS will mean that I will be probably deported, grabbed by ICE agent, and leave behind my daughter. She's in college. She needs my backup for stability, to have a roof over her head. And I don't know what's going to happen. I'm anxious. Every day I'm thinking about it. And it's certainly me, my son who is 30 years old, he just turned 30s, is living with TPS also.
So you have TPS and your son has TPS. You're very brave to come on the air, but you're speaking for so many people. Are we talking about hundreds of thousands of Haitians in the United States? You came here after the horrific earthquake that took place in Haiti, what, like 16 years ago?
Yes. Yes, I came here with my kids. And I'm still living in the United States, and I was never been illegal here because since 2010, I have TPS. They renew it over and over again. And I work, I pay tax, I'm a good citizen, I don't bother nobody. I do what I have to do. During my time here, I take care of a gentleman who was a pilot during World War II for 7 years. And I'm still doing it, helping elders with activity of daily living. And the end of TPS next week, it's like it will be like another earthquake to me.
Gerlene Joseph, the U.S. Embassy has removed 80 to 90% of its staff in Haiti due to security concerns in the country. Can you talk about the conditions on the ground there? If people like Maurice Baltazar, who has worked here in this country, and it's a real question about what this means for health care, as you described, for example, Maurice, taking care of this World War II vet, what this would mean?
This will mean extreme hardship, not only for the Haitians, but also for the United States as a whole. At the end of last year, the U.S. Embassy in Haiti had a webinar where they clearly stated that Haiti is currently at a stage 4 do not travel, like a war zone. And they have also said that they have removed about 80 to 90% of their personnel in Haiti due to insecurity. But at the same time, they are saying that it is safe enough for 500,000 Haitians to be returned. And we also want to highlight that the Haitian TPS holders in the United States have invested $5.9 billion into the U.S. economy. They are like Maurice, our nurses, our nurses assistants, our healthcare workers, our meat packing industry, our agriculture, workers, really centering and uplifting the life of people here in the United States. And keep in mind, currently we have 1.4 million people who are internally displaced in Haiti. The impact of terminating TPS for Haiti not only will have a big sustainable failure here in the United States, but we have to understand that those people are the ones supporting over 4 million people back home in Haiti. It is in the best interest of President Trump and the U.S. government to redesignate and extend TPS for Haiti, both to make sure that Haiti is somewhat being taken care of with the remittance being sent, but also centering the fact that we as Haitian Americans, specifically TPS holders, are investing over $5.9 billion in the United States, paying their taxes. They are homeowners and business owners, making sure that we continue to move forward.
Maurice Baltazar, we just have 30 seconds. Are you afraid for your life? What kind of danger do you face if you're deported to Haiti?
I was a journalist, and Now I don't have any control of a PowerPoint because I haven't been there for 16 years now. I don't know what I will face for sure because everything is upside down. I don't know nobody anymore. All my contacts are living abroad in the United States, in Canada, all over. And I don't know.
Maurice Baltasar, I want to thank you for being with us, certified nurse from Haiti living in the U.S. with TPS protections. Thank you so much. Her son also has TPS, her daughter an American citizen, and Gerline Joseph of the Haitian Bridge Alliance. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Iran. The New York Times reports President Trump has been presented in recent days with a, quote, expanded list of potential military options against Iran aimed at doing further damage to the country's nuclear and missile facilities or weakening Iran's supreme leader, unquote. The current options include sending U.S. forces inside Iran to carry out raids. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth spoke during Trump's cabinet meeting Thursday.
Same thing with Iran right now, ensuring that they have all the options to make a deal. They should not pursue nuclear capabilities. We will be prepared to deliver whatever this president expects of the War Department.
Meanwhile, inside Iran, Reuters reports security forces have rounded up thousands of people in an attempt to prevent renewed anti-government protests. According to the U.S.-based Human Rights Activist News Agency, over 6,000 protesters were killed since December, but some believe to be a vast undercount. For more, we're joined by Sepida Farsi, Iranian filmmaker and activist, the director of most recently the Oscar-nominated documentary Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk. Sepida Farsi was born and raised in Iran. She was jailed for almost a year as a teenager in Iran for helping a political dissident in her high school. Since 2009, she can't go back to Iran due to her films and her political statements. Sepida, explain what's happening there in Iran right now. You're deeply critical of the Iranian government, but also critical of the U.S. threats to strike Iran.
Yes. Hi, Amy. Thanks for talking about Iran. I was just listening to the statement you broadcasted. I am amazed that they talk about everything except the Iranian people who are losing their lives. This is my main concern now, to prevent the bloodshed, to stop it. Of course, I'm against Khamenei and the whole regime. And I am also very concerned about a possible military intervention because it would only worsen the situation. As we remember last June, it only reinforced the regime when Israel first started the so-called preemptive attacks and America followed. They didn't end the nuclear capacities of Iran because they're still talking about it. And they did not harm the regime because all those who were killed by them were replaced. And now, even if they hit Khamenei, somebody else would take over. This is not the way to do. And we are hearing about tens of thousands of killed people, people arrested. Many of my friends have been called in for interrogation. Doctors are being arrested. Lawyers are being arrested, kidnapped. And there are death sentences pronounced against people, activists, which will go if this attack would happen. This is really my concern, that what would go on in Iran if they do this. They would destroy part of the country, perhaps part of the regime's capacity, but the regime will not fall. We've already seen this.
How many people do you think have been killed? How many people have been arrested? What do you base your information on?
It's very hard to evaluate that. And even one life is too much gone, you know. I mean, but I've seen, and I see every day, every time I go on social media, I see new names coming up. Right now, the latest, quite believable, I would say, but I'm not, you know, a human rights, NGO, and all the figures are quite kind of under. But we are, I saw a count which was city by city, and that was a bit more than 30,000, 30,274 to be precise. And we're talking about 100,000 people injured in the eye who lost one or two eyes. We're talking about tens of thousands of arrestees. more people who are being called in, all those who might in one way or another help wounded people or defend prisoners are now being called in to be jailed or to be interrogated. It's a total disaster, total disaster.
During the nationwide uprising, Iranian security forces apparently killed dozens of protesters in the market of the Caspian Sea city of Rasht on the night of January 8th. We turn now to a rare eyewitness testimony of that apparent massacre. For the safety of the eyewitness, we're keeping her identity concealed.
You know what happened? She told me that they made a mistake by running away through the alleys. She said they should have stayed with the main group, the mass of the people, but instead they ran into the alleys. But whoever went into the alleys and the side streets was shot by the forces and killed. They tracked them down there and cornered them and shot them. She said, I was running away and they shot me once, and when I continued running, one of them followed and hit me with a baton. But because I continued to run, they shot me a second time. And when I fell down to the ground, they thought I was dead and they left me. After they left, I crawled to a fruit shop, and the shopkeeper is the one who took me to the hospital. As if we are not human beings. It's as if we are all running away from a mass murder. What happened to her could have happened to any of us there earlier that night. At the beginning of the evening, you didn't see any special forces there around the town hall where the rally and the gathering had started and was taking place. And there were so many people at the rally. The gathering was so crowded, so big. But not one of the protesters attacked any of the administrative buildings. No one attacked the town hall. No damage was done by the protesters to the administrative buildings nor to the banks. You can't imagine. You can't imagine the size of the rally. How many people were there? And then the military forces, came back by the evening. Why did they come and start rounding up all the young people and burning buildings? A number of people had taken shelter in the bazaar, and that's where they opened machine guns on them, and they killed them all. It was a rain of bullets. I was farther away, and I was hearing the bullets, the gunshots, and I thought, well, there are so many people. The military forces cannot do anything. So they're just shooting in the air to scare people. But it turns out that they were actually shooting on the people and killing them. Killing them.
We're not identifying this eyewitness, Sepi Defarsi, in this last minute or so that we have left. Your message to the United States, to Israel, to Iranian protesters and to the world?
Iranian protesters are cut off from the world, but they are looking at us. About less than 20% of the internet traffic is now established, but it's still very weak. My message to America, to the United States, and to Israel is, please think of the Iranian people. If you are thinking of democracy in Iran, and I do believe deeply that a democratic Iran is the best partner for any of those countries to deal with afterwards, leave it to the Iranian people. Please put maximum pressure, but diplomatic pressure. IRGC has been listed by Europe, the European Council, yesterday, finally, as a terrorist organization. They can freeze their assets. Please stop dealing with this regime and do not do a military attack. I don't believe that. That is not for the interests of the people. That is, again, to strike a deal, as Trump wants to. This is not for Iranian people. This is just for business.
I want to thank you so much, Sepi Defarsi, for being with us from Paris, France. Iranian filmmaker and activist once jailed in Iran. Director most recently of Put Your Soul on Your Hand and Walk. That does it for our show. On Monday, February 23rd, Democracy Now! Will be celebrating our 30th anniversary at the historic Riverside Church in New York. Our guests will include Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, REM's Michael Stipe, Wynton Marsalis, the jazz legend, Masab Abu-Toha, V, Hooray for the Riff Raff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Looking for work that fits your schedule and can help make a difference in your community? Statistics Canada is hiring approximately 32,000 people across Canada for the 2026 census. Census jobs offer competitive pay, flexible hours, valuable experience, and the chance to help collect data that shape programs and services in your community. Apply today at census.gc.ca/jobs. A message from the Government of Canada.